And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. My guest today was last on my show almost a year ago. And my, how the world has changed since then. On that occasion, we talked about the U.S. Army quitting Afghanistan, the consequences and implications, but also the significance of 100,000 Russian troops amassing on their border with Ukraine. Since February, as you well know, we've had a war much closer to us as Russia illegally invaded Ukraine 8 months ago. Casualties mount, both military and civilian, and the two sides seem to be locked increasingly in a deadly war of rhetoric and bombardment from artillery and drones, not forgetting the strangling effect as the northern winter approaches that the conflict is having on the supply of oil, gas, and grains in Europe and what's called nowadays the Global South. It's an extremely difficult and delicate situation with many ramifications, not only militarily, but also politically, economically, and socially, and one about which my guest has particular insights. Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, formerly he was the commander of the United States Army in Europe, based in Wiesbaden in Germany, retiring in 2017. He's a career army man, having graduated from West Point in 1980 and served in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Korea, and Turkey, where he was NATO Allied Land Commander. He's speaking to me today via Zoom from Germany. Welcome back, General Hodges. Ben, it's good to have you with us again on the McKay Interview. Good to see you on the screen. In fact, the screen is turned off, Ben, but it's good to have you back with us.
Michael, thank you very much for the privilege.
Ben, I know you're pressed for time. You told me you're rushing off on a flight tomorrow. My first question is about men and machines. What's your assessment of the current situation regarding the balance of fighting men and women and material between Russia and Ukraine at the current rate of usage? Is Ukraine able to sustain its attack capability in order to achieve victory? And if not, what more material does it need? And what is your estimate of the state of Russia's conventional weapons inventory?
Michael, we know from history that war is a test of will and it's a test of logistics. Ukrainians, the soldiers as well as the population, clearly have superior will to Russia. We see that every day manifested in so many different ways. Ukrainians do not have a manpower problem. They have over 700,000 people in uniform right now. Not all are fully trained, but they do not have a manpower shortage. They have a training shortage, and they're working on that. Meanwhile, the Russians have had to, they're dealing with all sorts of manpower problems. This partial mobilization has been a catastrophe, and they demonstrated the lack of will they have when 500,000 military-age male Russians left the country. Avoid being mobilized.
Yeah.
So in terms of will, it's very clear that Russians, you know, they're the invading force. The Ukrainians are defending their home.
Yeah.
In terms of logistics, the Ukrainian logistical system is not ideal, but it gets a little bit better every week as we, the West, continue to deliver capability and as the Ukrainians improve and strengthen their distribution system. Whereas on the Russian side, their logistics system is exhausted. It's having to do things for which it was not designed, which is to sustain a long-term land operation outside of Russia. And the Ukrainians have skillfully gone after that logistics system. And this has been part of the reason for Russian collapse and failure over the past several weeks. In terms of what we still need to be providing, it's missile defense capability to protect the literally millions of Ukrainian civilians who are exposed to missile attacks and drones. That's murder by the Kremlin. But also they still need long-range precision weapons like HIMARS that enable them to strike specific targets inside Russian bases and Russian command and control nodes.
That was my next question to you, Ben, because obviously I'm a novice in this area. I've never served in the military, and many of our listeners will be too. Would you explain briefly what the different kinds of weapon systems being supplied by the United States, by the UK and other allies of Ukraine actually do to advance Ukraine's battle aims? I mean, Stinger and Javelin are just two that spring to mind, but non-military people like me don't really understand what these different weapons do except to destroy.
Okay, so in the beginning of the war, of course, we provided Javelin, the UK provided In-Law. These are man-portable anti-tank weapons that are effective out to 1, 2, or 3 kilometers, and then the Ukrainians employed them very skillfully to destroy Russian tanks that were not employed very skillfully. The Stinger is a shoulder-fired, again, man-portable air defense weapon.
That's like a bazooka.
No, it looks like that, but it's not a direct fire weapon like a bazooka.
I see.
It's something that you would use against a helicopter or a drone, or you could also use it against jets, although it's not ideal for trying to shoot down fast moving aircraft like that.
Yeah.
So this was early days, and it really points to the evolution of the White House and others on what they were willing to provide. Because there was all this, I think, over anxiousness about potential Russian escalation. I mean, there was a time 7 months ago where the White House was hesitant to give Stinger because they were concerned that if an American-made Stinger was used to shoot down a Russian helicopter, that somehow the Russians might escalate. And that just seems really silly now. We're so far beyond that.
Yeah.
The weapon that has been provided that has had the most dramatic effect in the last few months has been HIMARS.
What does that do?
HIMARS, of course, is an acronym for High Mobility Rocket System, which is basically a truck with a rocket launcher on the back of it. It can fire 2 or 3 different kind of weapons, but the one that's being used now is a rocket that's good out to about 40 miles. And it has a GPS guidance system on it, so it's extremely accurate, and it has a warhead that is devastating against if it hits an ammunition storage site, or maybe it hits a headquarters, or it hits a cluster of Russian vehicles or artillery, these kinds of targets.
Yeah,
it is very good, and the Ukrainians have used this whenever they could find ammunition storage or headquarters. Those are the kind of targets that they were going after, because that's what has the greatest long-term effect.
Okay. Thank you. That helps a lot to understand what these different words mean. Ben, we've heard the expression quite often, turning point, used by all manner of commentators in the West. Is that unrealistically optimistic? I mean, and is that an expression which you would use to describe the situation as we speak?
You know, I've been pressed several times to ask, was this the turning point? Was this the turning point?
Yeah.
And I don't know that those are useful, because actually, I don't think you can identify a turning point until you've gone way past it.
I see.
When you look back and say, aha, that's when it happened.
Mm.
I do subscribe to the Clausewitzian concept of culminating point, which is Clausewitz describes the culminating point as when an attacker runs out of impetus, either because of casualties or lack of resources or lack of will, or, you know, enemy determined defense and resistance. And it looked to me that the Russians were going to culminate in their attack back in August, and that's what happened. And it was because their logistics had run out and the Ukrainians had put up such a stout defense. And I think that the Ukrainians understood the culminating point as well, and they saw that the Russians were not going to be able to continue offensive operations, not quit, not be defeated, but they could not continue offensive operations. And they saw this was going to happen back around August. So probably, I would say, as early as May or June, they began planning their own counteroffensive, timed with Russian forces reaching their culminating point when they would be at their most vulnerable.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So that's why the Ukrainians launched their counteroffensive in the first week of September, where they went after Kherson in the south and Kharkiv in the north. And of course, it met with huge success throughout most of the month of September. So that was important there. This was when, as we look back, this is when Ukraine achieved what I would call irreversible momentum. There is no turning it back. The Russians are not going to be able to undo this.
I see. No, it's important to try to understand what these expressions mean, because I can imagine that quite often, particularly in the media, but also in just ordinary conversation, one has a sense of optimism, and these expressions are very easy to say, but we don't really know what they mean, what the implications are.
You're right.
And I wanted to ask you this one about Ukraine, and it expresses the intention to expel Russia from all its territory, including Crimea. What I don't really understand is what that will take militarily. What does your experience tell you, as a very experienced and senior military officer, will be the likely cost in soldiers' lives and in civilian lives? And I emphasize civilian lives because Russia appears to have no compunction about killing women and children to achieve their war aims. And Ukraine is, after all, not bombarding Russia. But what will it take to expel Russia from Crimea militarily?
Well, it's important, and I'm glad you raised this. Crimea is part of Ukraine. So every now and then somebody will say, okay, but not Crimea. I mean, as if it's some kind of separate sort of thing that somehow Russia's entitled to it and it has some sort of kryptonite properties. It is just as much a part of Ukraine as Florida is a part of the United States or Bavaria is a part of Germany. Yeah. And so, yes, of course, the government of Ukraine has announced that they have every intention of liberating all of their sovereign territory, which does, in fact, include Crimea. Now, how is this going to happen? And by the way, I think Ukrainian forces are going to keep pushing Russian forces back to the line of 23 February by the end of this year. So in other words, back to where things were when Russia launched their latest attack on 24 February this year.
That's not far away, Ben.
That's two months. And they're actually very close to it right now, especially yeah. this large Russian force that's down in Kherson in the south. They're already evacuating civilians out of there, and they've been trying to get equipment out of there. Once that goes, then I think you're going to see more rapid advances by Ukrainian forces. So I do believe it's very likely that they will be at the 23 February line within the next 2.5 months.
And and when you say that, you include taking Crimea, or is that a separate story?
No. The 23 February line, where yeah. they were on 23 February. Okay. And then by middle of summer, next summer, they will have liberated Crimea.
I see. So I didn't quite understand.
That's my assessment of how Ukraine will progress. Now, how do they get to Crimea? Of course, Crimea is a peninsula.
Yes.
And there's a very narrow isthmus called Perekop that connects Crimea to the mainland of Ukraine. It's a lot of water. It's difficult. It's always been a choke point that would occupy. The other connection for Crimea, of course, is this long Kerch Bridge, mm-hmm. which we hit a few weeks ago. The fact that it's been hit and disabled to some extent and won't be fully operable until sometime next year is a real problem for the Russians, because in order to supply all of their forces in southern Ukraine, they were using that bridge, or they come down on what's called the land bridge along the coast of the Sea of Azov through yeah. Mariupol, Berdansk, Melitopol, and into Crimea. And that is going to be increasingly treacherous because Ukrainian forces are getting closer.
I see.
And so if you can imagine Ukraine's counteroffensive having a left wing and a right wing, the right wing is now at Kherson. The left wing is the one that's coming down from the north, from Kharkiv down towards Crimea. And another way to look at this is all roads lead to Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon, after they push Russian forces all the way back to the 23 February line, they're going to have HIMARS, this long-range rocket system. That's
40 kilometers, you said, or 40 miles.
40 miles.
40 miles, yeah.
Yeah, so we're talking about 80 kilometers.
Yeah.
We'll soon be within range of the Russian air bases and Navy bases in Crimea.
Yeah.
and when they when they're able to start hitting those facilities in Crimea, then Crimea becomes untenable. The Russian Navy has already relocated their submarines from Sevastopol to a Russian base over in Novorossiysk, also on the Black Sea. The Black Sea fleet has pretty much been a non-factor since their flagship was sunk back in April.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah.
And so this is why I am optimistic that they will be able to take Crimea, because they're going to be able to render the military installations untenable there. And by the way, once they have pushed the Russians out of Kherson, they will be able to control the canal that diverts water from the Dnipro River down into Crimea. And so then they're going to be able to turn off that water.
Well, it sounds very much like a squeeze would be put on Putin's troops, slowly but surely.
Correct.
Ben, I'm not sure how easy this is a question to answer or not, but you said already that Russia has enacted partial mobilization of military reservists. But based on your experience, Ben, how does an army get such men into fighting shape, especially if motivation is low, as it appears to be? There have been a lot of desertions and young men running to go to Georgia and other places. And the new recruits are not defending, as you said, their own families and soil as the Ukrainian soldiers are. What do commanding officers up and down the military hierarchy do and need to do? And could you explain briefly, if possible, the difference between Russian military command culture and, in your personal experience, United States Army command culture?
Yeah. So keep in mind, for basic training for the U.S. Army, just to take a person off the street and turn them from a civilian into a soldier who knows how to put on his uniform correctly, how to fire a weapon, gets them in some reasonable sense of physical condition, can do the most basic soldier things, that's 10 weeks. They do that. That's basic training for 10 weeks. And then they go for another 8 to 10 weeks for specialized training to become an engineer or an infantry or military police or artillery or whatever their specialty is. So we're talking several months. And these poor, unlucky men who were mobilized, who were not lucky enough to get out of Russia, they're being sent in many cases with about 10 days of preparation, not properly equipped. And especially as the weather gets worse here over the next month or two, this is a catastrophe. And it's criminal to send soldiers into combat who are not trained or equipped. But the Kremlin, as you highlighted, does not care. They are trading bodies for time. This is all an attempt to slow down the Ukrainians and kind of drag this war out in hopes that we will all lose interest. Now, the command philosophy, which was your specific question, you've got two completely different styles. The Russian model, which was the Soviet model, is a very centralized, top-down, here's your order, move from here to here, don't stop, don't ask questions, we don't need you being creative, just move. And so it's based on mathematical calculations, actually. So it does not reward or encourage initiative or risk-taking or decision-making on the ground when the situation is different or calls for it. Whereas in Western armies, particularly the British, Canadian, U.S. Army, and others, German Army, have this more decentralized command and control where junior leaders are expected, encouraged and expected to make decisions on their own based on what they see happening in front of them.
Yeah.
As long as they are contributing towards progress, towards the overall purpose of the mission. And Ukrainians have been with us now for over 30 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they have become a much more Western-oriented military. Yeah. And so what you're seeing on the battlefield in Ukraine are Ukrainian forces acting like American or British or Canadian forces in terms of this low-level decision-making compared to the Russian centralized. And so this is part of the reason why Ukraine has been so successful in what they're doing.
I see. Thanks, Ben. My guest today is Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, U.S. Army retired, former commander of the United States Army Ben, the clocks fall back 1 hour next week, and the Northern Hemisphere winter will be upon us. What, in your experience, is the impact and significance of the Ukrainian winter on fighting men?
So it's going to be miserable for soldiers who are out there. Of course, I mean, Russians, Ukrainians, they live there, so they deal with harsh winters. But it's a different thing when you're talking about living in a bunker or a trench line. You're trying to fight in these kind of conditions. The soil in the southeastern part of Ukraine is particularly nasty when it gets wet. And so it will affect trafficability off-road for armored vehicles and wheeled vehicles. That will be a challenge for both sides. And also the weather will limit visibility for drones. So yeah, we'll see what kind of impact that has. However, the advantage, in my view, is going to be for Ukraine because, again, there's the morale factor for them is so much higher, so much more positive than it is for Russians, particularly since so many of them are people that don't want to be there. Secondly, Ukraine is being resupplied with cold weather uniforms. I think Germany has donated, donating about 90,000 sets of cold weather gear. And if you're properly outfitted for cold weather and wet weather, and you've got the opportunity, the logistical system allows you to rotate, to replace, and do these things, you can operate like that for an extended period of time. Mm. Russians are not going to be properly equipped. As I mentioned, their logistical system is already in tatters, and all of these new soldiers that are showing up don't even have basic regular stuff, let alone, you know, the top quality cold weather gear. And so I think and if you're not trained, you're not disciplined, and you don't have sergeants, and the Russian army does not have sergeants, not like what we talk about in Western militaries.
Oh, tell me what's the significance of a sergeant for a man who's not been in the army? Tell me about sergeants.
Think about if you're in a factory, you have management, that's the officers, and then you have the shop foreman, the guy that's on the floor, who's worked there for years, knows how to do everything, probably kind of a tough guy experience, and he or she is showing everybody else how to do stuff. Yeah. Well, that's what a sergeant is. A sergeant is somebody that's been in the Army for many years or several years, more than a brand new private. Knows how to survive in bad weather, knows how to use all the equipment, understands what's required. And so in the absence of that, what you have are people who are inexperienced and they're in this terrible weather. It's unsanitary. They're not doing the things they should. And you become very, very susceptible to disease.
So
you can
imagine
COVID racing through the ranks of people that are huddling in trenches or bunkers or tents. And if they're not doing all the stuff they're supposed to do. So I'm painting a pretty grim picture here, but this is exactly what it's going to be like inside these Russian formations.
I've got two more questions to squeeze in, Ben. They're quite different, but at the same time, I think you'll understand why I put them to you. I'm sure the listeners will be interested to hear what you have to say. But first one's about tactical nuclear weapons and a series of big hypothetical questions for you. If Putin ends up completely cornered, and if there is no effective move to topple him internally, and were he to be removed, if whoever replaces him is worse than he is, what would the use of tactical nuclear weapons by Putin look like? What measures would a country under attack take to defend itself? And, I mean, as you know, after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Ukraine held about one-third of the Soviet nuclear arsenal. I think it was the largest or the third largest in the world. And then they gave them up according to treaty. But you, as a former commanding general, your job must have been to think the unthinkable and prepare your men and women for it. What does your former training tell you now regarding tactical nuclear weapons and their possible uses?
So Russia does have thousands of tactical nuclear weapons. These are not the ones that are in silos and missiles that would be launched against North America, for example. These are weapons that could be employed by artillery or on rockets or other devices that are much, much less yield, if you will, explosive yield than the strategic ones. And they were designed, the Soviet doctrine was to use these weapons against NATO if they needed to blow open a gap, if you will, like in the North German plain or in the Fulda Gap. You would use these there. The Soviet troops were trained to move through these contaminated areas quickly and to exploit the gap that had been created, or to exploit the advantage of a large NATO formation that would have been destroyed. Those conditions don't exist. The Russians have no force. There is no exploitation force to go through a gap that might be created. And also, given the nature of the environment and in the current situation, the Ukrainians are not in some large mass somewhere where they would present an easy target. So in other words, there is no battlefield advantage for Russia to use a tactical nuclear weapon. And the tactical nuclear weapons, unlike the missiles that are in silos, we would be able to see as they were pulling these things out of storage and preparing to use them and moving them around. And there would be a lot of people in the Ukrainian general staff and chain of command involved. I don't believe that they will do this. I don't believe that Russia will actually use a nuclear weapon because there is no tactical advantage. And because they know that the United States will have to become directly involved if they did do this, because we know that the Chinese, the North Koreans, the Iranians, and others are watching to see whether or not we respond.
Yeah.
And my president has already said, of course, we will respond. Now, that response may be nuclear, non-nuclear, kinetic, non-kinetic, or some combination. We'll see. But I think that most of the people around Vladimir Putin and the general staff, they know this. And they're thinking about life after Putin. And they see that there are zero upsides for them to use a nuclear weapon. It will not change the battlefield other than killing a lot of innocent people. And it will not help keep Putin in power. This is why I think it's very unlikely that he would use it. Those nuclear weapons are actually more effective when they don't use them, because it causes all of us to worry that he might use them.
Yeah. You painted a very compelling story of Ukraine's great strengths, despite the disparity, if you like, in size. But I have to ask you this final question. Isn't it the case that as the conflict intensifies, and even if the Ukrainians, as you explained so lucidly, appear to be making advantage, that Russia retains the capacity over time to damage Ukraine more than Ukraine can damage Russia? I just look on the television screen and see this mass carnage that they are extracting on so many of the towns and cities. Therefore, surely it makes sense, if my premise is correct, but tell me if I'm wrong, to save the loss of countless lives for the United States as the major party providing weapons, to work much harder to broker a ceasefire that leads to negotiations for peace. Difficult as that would be for Ukraine. I quote former American Ambassador Jack Matlock. I'm sure you know of him, or you may even know him personally. He uses the expression "reality trumps illusion" whenever the two conflict. Well, how would you reply to Jack Matlock, Ambassador Jack Matlock?
Well, with all respect, I read Ambassador Matlock's latest piece, and it is probably some of the worst analysis and most out of touch with reality, outdated diplomatic recommendations I have read in months.
He's behind the times.
He is tone deaf. And frankly, he's been wrong for so long, and he's always been frustrated that he was not recognized as the genius of understanding Russia. He clearly does not understand Russia. The Russians will, I mean, who in the world really believes that if Ukraine said, okay, you can have Crimea, Or you can have the Donbass if you stop murdering our people, who believes that Russia would stop? That there's nothing in their history that suggests that they would actually stop. And so why in the world would we in the West want to reward Putin's aggression, use of force to change European borders, murdering thousands of innocent Ukrainian civilians? And by the way, there's over a million Ukrainians who have been deported and scattered all around Russia, exactly what Stalin did.
Why
in the world would anybody think we could negotiate with somebody like Vladimir Putin? Look, the Russians are about to collapse. I don't think Putin will be in power a year from now. I don't think the Russian Federation will look like it does now, a year from now. I'm not advocating a coup. I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying that there are so many forces at play. There's huge fights going on inside the Kremlin, I believe. And we need to stick with Ukraine, help them be successful. The sooner that they can defeat Russia, the better. And people should get their heads around the idea that, yes, Russia is going to be defeated. It's not our job to help Vladimir Putin find an off-ramp. He has 11 time zones behind him. He could leave today. And Dr. Timothy Snyder, who is somebody I do greatly respect, recently wrote that, yes, it's bad to lose in Ukraine. It's much worse to lose in Russia. And so I think some of the power brokers are going to be are starting to pull back some of their forces. I'm talking about Kadyrov, the Chechen guy, Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner Group, this guy Savorkin, who's the new commander. I think all of these guys are starting to think about, okay, they actually are losing in Ukraine, but now they've got to worry about protecting themselves back in Russia. And that's why I think we're going to see a different set of circumstances here by next summer.
Ben, thanks so much for this full and frank of the current situation and what the future might look like. My guest today has been Lieutenant General retired Ben Hodges, holder of the Pershing Chair in Strategic Studies at the Center for European Policy Analysis and formerly Commander of the United States Army in Europe. Thank you for your time, Ben. Much appreciated.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.